Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said.
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Isn't that what I just said? What is wrong with you?
Is it the Pelicans? I didn't know it was the Pelicans.
Oh,
I
know
nothing
you're like,
about the word Pelicans.
Yes.
I worked during the fucking day, okay? Well, then what's the point of...
Scott Russo. What would be the point of that?
What's the point of giving her the Rockers theme? I don't know! You know what? I'm from now on just going to read. And if you want to comment, be my guest.
Just read things that are up to date. How about that?
Just shut up. I'm done. I'm not talking about
it. I don't know what the fuck the Department of Health is.
To do worse than Josh Richards.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you for the third time this week from deep inside the PTV Man Cave. And of all weeks, Scott, that I need to be doing three shows is the week that my voice is in rough, rough shape.
JR, it is always a pleasure. It figures three shows in 4-5 days. You've got no voice. I'm coming off of
You've got
some
no
type
heart.
Of chest thing. I'm a black heart, damn it! A winner! No. Yeah, I'm coughing, you're coughing, yeah, what a mess. But you know what?
I had to run I had to do a phone meeting today at work, and I sounded awful. Like, these people think I'm friggin' nuts, I'm on this call.
And now, part of our customer service department, here's Luna Bichon.
Yes.
In 2012.
Stu, one or the other.
All right, come on, let's get this interview on the way.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to 194. Jesus, JR, what's going on? Time is just... passing along.
Flying by. Can you believe we're almost, you know, it's not only that we're going to hit our 200th episode. I mean, it pretty much coincides with our 2-year anniversary since we've record, you know,
that's right,
on average 2 a week. So,
yeah,
pretty amazing. Pretty crazy that we are going to have done this for 2 full years now in come February.
Yeah. And it just gets better and better. And that's why I cannot wait for the weekend of WrestleMania, because to me that almost feels like, and I'll continue mentioning it as time progresses, as we get closer, I feel like that's our coup de grace, our magnum opus. You know, like,
so you're gonna you're gonna commit suicide at the end of Mania, and
yeah, yes.
End
the
story.
This is the greatest thing ever. I'm gonna jump off the fucking upper deck, and my head will explode in the parking
that'll
lot.
Be it. It'll be a beautiful end to this Shakespearean tale that we have going.
Stop at 200, like Jim Brown retiring in his prime, and just jump off the freaking.
It'll be like you and D'Amato will finally meet and and profess your feelings for each other, and then you'll each end things.
Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
Olio
and Juliet.
Olio. All right. It is episode 194 of the Place to Be Podcast. I hope everyone enjoyed episode 193. I thought you, me, and Mr. Forchetti had a nice spirited banter.
Yeah.
It was
good to talk about modern stuff, current stuff. We don't get into that as often anymore. I do want to take a minute, though, in case we have some new listeners. Go back to our archives, and you know, we're talking about our 200th episode. We got 193 of them in the bank. And yep. You can go to placetobe.podbean.com, and they're all there for you. Each episode is there, fully archived. So go back and check out our catalog. Ton of vintage vaults, ton of interviews we've done, and a lot of headline shows that I think, even though they're a little dated, still always stuff in there, little, you know, hidden gems and different things going on, and lists and other arguments and conversations we've had. And some of even the stuff that was dated is still current today based on topic and things that stay true in wrestling. So
exactly. Well, I mean, there's a lot of times where you and I have kind of try to foretell something, and
yeah,
you know, you can go back to episode 79 and you said, you know, the Miz is gonna flame out if he turns face, and it might have been right.
Right. So, and also list of manias we've done in the past. We ranked WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Survivor Series. We did the all-time we ranked every Survivor Series team of all time. We did the Ultimate Royal Rumble. You know, there's a lot of stuff we've done before, so definitely go back and check those out. Check our catalog out. A lot going on. there. And of course, we're about to add one more piece to the puzzle, one more great interview.
Yes, actually a sequel interview. Tonight, in the Place to Be a podcast, we are going to have part two of our awesome interview with one of the greatest managers and actually one of the greatest wrestlers, as we learned in part one, in terms of, you know, he had a few titles along the way, and obviously has been around all over the world, and that is, of course, the former head of the Horsemen, James J. Dillon. Now, we just want to preface, part two is going to be considerably shorter than part one. JJ has got a lot of stuff going on this weekend, so he's on a time limit. Just want to let you know that, so you don't think we kind of, like, you know, had a two-hour and then a little rinky-dink part two. We just want to let you know that. We're on a time limit tonight, so JJ was very kind to come back because we did go quite long in the first one. And the show was awesome, and he liked it.
Yeah.
We just kind of went longer than he's normally used to, but he's awesome, and he was very nice enough to come back tonight and talk to us. So, and tonight we'll go post-Horseman, kind of for our newer fans. You, me, and Dr. G kind of went back to our wheelhouse.
Your wheelhouse. This is more mine.
Me and Dr. G. Yeah, this is yours. Dr. G's in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, we did his whole, you know, how he got into the business. We did all his stuff overseas and different territories and in through the Horseman run. And we left off in 1988. So tonight we're going to pick up. We have about 10 to 11 questions we're going to hit him with. And they range from when he joined the WWF in the early 90s, or late 80s rather, his run through the early to mid 90s, and then finishing up with WCW in the late 90s where he was as well. So let's not waste any more time, Scott. Let's get things rolling. So why don't you bring the man in?
JJ, welcome back to the Place to Be podcast. It's an honor to have you on again.
Hey, guys. Glad to be back with you.
So, of course, we had an awesome journey in part one. We went through the early part of your career, all the territories, all the places you've been, the awesome stories, the great Dusty Rhodes story, and, of course, the run with the Horsemen. But tonight, we're going to focus post-Horsemen into your run when you went to work for the World Wrestling Federation, and then, of course, when you went to WCW. So what led to your departure from WCW in the late 80s and your entry into the World Wrestling Federation? And from there, what role did you take? First off, how did you leave WCW, NWA WCW?
I'm sorry, ask that again. How did I?
How did you, when you left the NWA WCW in 1988, what led to your departure in 1988?
Well, I back up to the phenomenal run with the Horsemen. And I had been in the business long enough to know that everything eventually runs its course. Nothing lasts forever. And there's a tendency when it's going well, your mind, your thought process doesn't go that way. You're just taking it day by day, just really enjoying it. However, after, a good 3 years, Tully and Arn felt, I don't know if, and I can't speak for them, I don't know if they felt burnt out, if they just thought that we had gotten everything out of it that could be had, but they had an opportunity to go to New York, which is where everybody really dreamed of going. Even back in the territory days, it was the biggest territory just because of the big population centers, and the guys that went there financially did well. And just the fact that, you know, that you were there. And I don't know how the discussion was initiated. I never got into that with them. I just know that eventually they made a decision to leave, to go up there. They're going to be managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan. And Bobby the Brain Heenan as the Brain Busters. So, I mean, that's, even if they had asked me privately, you know, well, what do you think we should do? I mean, my answer would have been the same. I mean, you guys, this is an opportunity of a lifetime. We've accomplished so much here. You know, you guys need to go. And it all happened at the same time that there were some red flags, kind of, some things with Crockett Promotions that just didn't seem right. Like the infrastructure of the company, I don't think, as I look back, was really prepared to deal with the degree of success that we enjoyed. And in other words, all of a sudden you get your paycheck one week and all the towns are on there but one. Oh, well, we're going to pay that next week. You know, just red flags. And then the rumors started that that they had borrowed some money because as a company they were in some financial trouble. Well, then the talks got more serious that Turner was in negotiations to buy Crockett Promotions before the thing, you know, got out of hand, because the program was doing well and he wanted to protect the programming. And then there was a due diligence process where actually some key people from Turner came in and wanted to talk to the key people that were with Crockett Promotions, of which I was one. Now, Tully and Arn had already left and were, you know, working for what was then the WWF. And, you know, what I kept hearing was, oh, things were going to be great. This was going to be a chance for Turner to get involved, the Turner organization, with all of their equipment as a broadcast company, their financial resources, the fact that they had programming that they distributed all over the world, that they could package WCW with. I mean, all positive things. And the one thing that we kept hearing was that, you know, we're not going to mess with the core product. We're just going to make available all these additional resources if this deal goes through. Well, long story short, the deal goes through, and the ink wasn't even dry, and all of a sudden, what I call closet wrestling fans in the upper organization started to surface with their opinions about how they could immediately turn things around. One of which was a guy who was a huge wrestling fan, and he said, I know what we can do to spike ratings. We'll immediately put Flair versus Sting on TV. And I said, okay. But I'm already thinking my whole life in the wrestling business, well, then before you do that, what are you going to do the week after and then the week after that? You know, and they're looking at you like, well, you know, we'll worry about that when the time comes. I mean, there just were some things that didn't seem right. They wanted to replace Dusty. A lot of pressure or a lot of blame fell on Dusty because, everything is cyclical. And when things are down, I guess it's no different than baseball, football. They don't fire the players. They fire the coach. And that's how they looked at Dusty. So as it turned out at the time, I had had a contract with Crockett, but the contract had expired. And I was just working without a contract, which was no big deal to me because contracts basically were unheard of until not that many years before that. Jim Barnett was working in the office, who was a powerful man in the industry. It had a lot to do with Vince McMahon starting his company. And Jim kept saying to me, we need to sit you down and get your deal done. And I just avoided getting into a discussion just to wait and see how things were going. And then I heard they were bringing in Jim Herd to run the organization. And I met Herd, and to say that I had some deep concerns would have been putting it mildly. I get a phone call out of the blue from Tully. And he says, I don't know what's going on down there. I don't know how happy you are, where you're figured in. I'm just relaying a message to you that up here, all of the matchmaking and all of the television creation, everything with pay-per-view is being done by Vince McMahon and Pat Patterson. They're running three tours a night. They desperately need some help and some things. Some people have said some very positive things about you personally, which they have, you know, further reinforced. So they said, if you're interested, they would like to talk to you if you want to initiate a call. So that's what happened. I called actually Terry Garvin, who passed away, who I had known from Kansas City and Amarillo, and he was working up there, and he was working under Pat Patterson, and I'd only met Pat once or twice, didn't know him that well. Anyway, called Terry. He put Pat on the phone. Oh, you know, and then that led to setting up a meeting to meet with Vince McMahon. And it was right before the holidays. I think the changeover from Crockett Promotions to start WCW as a separate company was like the 1st of November. And so this is just before Christmas. And I was going up to New York with my soon-to-be wife just to, you know, do a little shopping because we had some dates up in the area. And it ended up we were staying at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square, and arrangements were made for a car to be sent up and for me to go to Vince's home. And I met Vince at his home in Greenwich, and he didn't tell anybody that he was meeting me, and he said, you know, I don't want to, you know, what, not knowing what your situation is in Atlanta, you could either, you know, use this as a bargaining chip, or I'm hoping that, you know, we can talk further. And so he didn't want to meet me at the office for that reason. At the end of the discussion, he offered me a job, asked me what I wanted. I told him, and didn't want to take a huge step back from the money that I've been making, but realizing also that, you know, I wouldn't have a lot of expense anyway. I gave a number, and he said, if you want to come here, you got a job, but I would like to know as soon as possible. And if you want to go back and use this discussion as leverage, do so. And ended up called him back in a couple of days and took the job and gave my notice and took about a month off, and that's how I ended up there.
So you come in the late 80s, and as we progress into the early 90s, it hit kind of a rocky time in the WWF, of course, as the you know, sexual harassment trials and the steroid trials started to pop up. Was there ever a real fear backstage or within the hierarchy of Vince actually going to jail? And was this the reason behind the big talent purge at that time as well, with Warrior, Sid, Bulldog, Hogan all leaving? And just what was the feel? What was backstage? Was it palpable? Was Vince nervous? Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, for me, it was a period of transition, because when Vince hired me, he made it clear that he was not hiring me as an on-air talent, that basically I was walking off camera, that he was hiring me for my whatever I had to offer creatively, for my attention to detail. And he was hiring me strictly on the corporate level. So I, you know, got up there, and all of a sudden here was an operation that, by comparison to what I had seen with all the territories, where I had done basically all the functions that I'm seeing in this big corporate structure on a much smaller scale, where I would wear 10 hats, you now had 8 or 10 different people that were full-time experts in their field doing what I did before, obviously on a much larger scale. So it was very impressive. It was extremely well run. The first thing that you notice is that these aren't all wrestling fans. He hired people who were professionals, who were good at whatever their particular skill was. The only thing that Vince did expect was that everybody watch the program and be familiar with the program itself, not necessarily meaning you were a wrestling fan. And then there were some things that happened, the indictment, and it wasn't the kind of thing that you sat down with Vince to say, you know, what's going to happen. But I would work in the office Monday through Friday with a suit and tie, and most of the creative, and Vince was hands-on in everything. With every meeting he was involved, whether it was finalizing a poster for a pay-per-view or a cover for a video release, talking about new talent ideas. They had a department that would take an individual and then come up with suggestions for character development. So, I mean, this is like light years ahead of you know, what I was accustomed to. But it was obviously Vince was a take charge guy. All the creative was done basically on the weekend at his house. Very informal. Spend all day, often Saturday and Sunday, with just Vince, Pat, and I, and the summer would be out at the pool. He had a little veranda in case a shower or something came, and I basically watched Shane and Stephanie grow up in front of me while we would work in the summer, and in the winter when the weather was cold, we would be in his formal dining room at the table. When he was indicted, the only comment that I remember Vince making was that when the government spends that kind of money and that kind of effort to try and nail you, there's always that fear that they don't do it without getting something. They're going to get something, and they're going to get their pound of flesh. And so we proceeded kind of like, and it was almost in a joking manner too, where Vince would say, well, you know, if they convict me and I have to do time, you and Pat will have to come up on visiting days and bring your pen and pencil and take notes. And it was, you know, done in a joking manner. And I told Vince, I gave him a suggestion. I said, you know, worst case scenario, you know, if what you're saying is a concern that the government is going to get you somehow, one way or another, and you need some help running the operation, I said, I work for Jerry Jarrett. He basically has done everything that Vince has done and does everything that Vince does and done so successfully for a long time, be it on a much smaller scale. And Vince said, I'd like to talk to Jerry Jarrett. So I called Jerry and set up the phone conversation. They had several lengthy conversations, and then he had Jerry come up, had me have Jerry come up to Stanford, and Jerry actually stayed in his house for a couple weeks, I think, and then set him up in a hotel for him to stay after that, where he was going to stay longer, gave him a contract. And the only thing was, Jerry's son was the quarterback on the high school football team, and he wanted to go home on weekends to watch his son, and that was part of the deal. We'd fly him home every weekend to Nashville. And as it worked out, when the verdict came down, Jerry stayed on for a while, and then, you know, he finally said, Vince, you know, I mean, things worked out well for you. I don't know if there's any more I could do here. And so Jerry got a nice severance and went back to Tennessee. So that's kind of the inside story on really what happened. I can't say that Vince, he certainly didn't take the matter lightly. And this is just my personal opinion, I think that he was realistic that sometimes if they're out to get you, they're going to get you for something.
Mm-hmm.
And then that never happened. So when when all was said and done, and he was acquitted, there was a meeting at the main office, and all the employees came down into a conference room, and basically Vince said, "It's been a major distraction for him. Couldn't put 100% of his energy into all facets of the business." He said there was a matter of the legal fees, which had cost him about $5 million. So he said we need to, we need to recover that. So he said we're going to, kind of get lean and mean for a while. It's a one-time line item to take care of the legal fee. And he said, but now this clears my mind to focus back on the core business and go from there. And so it was kind of a rebuild from there.
No, it was a very interesting story, JJ.
Wow.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. back to the product itself for a minute. WrestleMania 8, Hoosier Dome, Indianapolis. One of the two companies, either NWA or WWF, was possibly going to have Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair on their roster at the same time. Turned out that it was Vince that had them both at the same time. So the question is very simple, JJ. Why did they not do Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair at WrestleMania 8? It seemed ready-made.
Well, it ended up... Pat was on hiatus for a while, and mm-hmm. I was directly involved with that particular WrestleMania. Actually, it was written by just Vince and I. And I'm not taking credit for having written it, but the circle was much smaller at that particular point. Vince would take a match and put it out to kind of get a feel for it before he would build. Now, it's a different time now. You can't do that nowadays because the internet and what have you.
Oh yeah.
Everything is instantaneous.
Pretty much, yeah.
But back then, you could. Mm-hmm. And so there were a series of matches booked between Hulk and Flair. And to everybody's surprise, I think, box office-wise, it didn't do what we all had anticipated that it would. And the straw that broke the camel's back was when they wrestled in the Sun Dome in Tampa, which was Hulk's home. It was right there in his backyard where he was very strong, had a great track record of success. And the match did not do well at all. And Vince, one thing that he is, he's a very smart businessman. He doesn't get emotionally involved with something that is an idea or a concept where he just gets obsessed with, well, I'm going to make it work at all costs. And he just, if I remember correctly, made the comment that this thing came together and this particular match, which seemed like a dream match on paper, happened 5 years too late. And I think that logic had a lot to do with him then deciding to change directions. And I don't remember the specifics of how things came together from there, but that was the reason why the Hulk Flair match never took place at WrestleMania.
What was the feeling like backstage and in the company a couple years later when Hogan went to WCW?
Vince always had this feeling that the brand, and by the brand I mean whether it's WWF or now a public company, WWE, was stronger than any one individual. And I really think that, and I'm not basing this on a conversation or any privileged information, but it's like, I think Hulk would lead you to believe that he was the key to Vince's success. And yet, if you somehow had somebody that was a confidant of Vince, they would say, well, he created the opportunity and gave Hulk he made Hulk Hogan. And the truth is probably somewhere in between, that Vince created the opportunity. Hulk ran with the ball and far exceeded probably what anybody thought he would accomplish. And it was a combination that just did extremely well. But there wasn't anybody in Vince's eyes that was not expendable. And I really believe that. So he would have wanted someone to not be there if he felt that it was not in their heart that they wanted to be there, that the company was better off without it. one thing that immediately comes to mind was Vince talked about the day that he thought that the advertising for the WWE was going to be there without advertising specific matches would come. And I, with my background in the business, thought that there's no way possible that could ever happen. Mm-hmm. And it has happened, where matchmaking for a lot of these shows were not based on traditional thinking of hot issues between two people, where the old days interviews were done that were market specific, where you'd hear from one, hear from the other, mm-hmm. and then they would tag, you know, that match would then go everywhere, and they would tag, you know, the city and the venue and what have you.
So one major night during this time as well came in Canada, Saskatoon, when Bret Hart shockingly won the world title from Ric Flair. Can you just give us the background to how that all came about? Because as a fan at the time, not really in the know, this just came completely out of left field. Was there anyone else in the running to take the belt from Flair? What was the rush to get it off of him, and why Bret?
You know, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't remember. I was there for almost 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I first got there, like, there were three tours a night, and there were two television programs that were syndicated that were done every third week. And then when you had your pay-per-views, of which I think there were only five, then it was a logistical nightmare to do a pay-per-view on a Sunday and then 3 hours of TV Monday and 3 hours of TV Tuesday. As close as I am to Flair, I do not remember why. It was Bret Hart. I can say this, that Vince always had a image of what he thought a wrestler should look like. And if you look at the history of the company, you could see that there were more Hulk Hogan-looking types, Lex Luger-looking types, Ultimate Warrior-looking types, Superstar Billy Graham. I mean, you can go down the list. Mm-hmm. I think one of the influences, a positive influence, that Jerry Jarrett had for the time he was there, that he somehow caused Vince to kind of broaden his horizons to look at some of these guys that weren't so-called great physical specimens that still had the ability to draw great money. And Bret Hart would be an example. Shawn Michaels would be a great example. Mm-hmm. I think prior to Jerry Jarrett, I don't consider Bret Hart a small guy, but by comparison to the other guys that have been featured there, I don't know that Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels would have had the opportunity that was given to them, and both of which paid off handsomely. Both did extremely well.
Now, when we head to 1995, which is probably one of the most polarizing years in terms of fandom in WWF history. Vince tried to maybe recreate the Hogan run of a big, you know, big monster babyface type character with Diesel. And of course, it had its ups and it had its downs. Talk about that year when Diesel was champion and what you thought the ups or the downs were, how the year went in general.
I think it's the nature of the business that, and I don't care how strong a track record you have as a creative person. Mm-hmm. The nature of the business is such that and it's one of the great appeals of the business is that you come up with ideas and you come up with a concept that you convince yourself, I mean, this is it. It cannot miss. And you run with it, and you do your best to make it successful. But what I found along the way and had it reinforced many times that no matter how smart you think you are or how great an idea you think something is, the ultimate decision maker as to whether it succeeds or fails is the wrestling fan. They either like it or they don't. Mm-hmm. And so you go with something, and this, I mean, you could take this down even to an individual character. All the characters are created, some that you think, oh boy, this is going to be hot, can't miss. And it just falls flat in its face. And then there are others that you are there, don't get the television time or emphasis that you might be putting on something else, but for some unknown reason, it clicks, and the fans, they elevate it. And then you have to be smart enough to see what's happening and be able to shift gears and say, oh, there's something here, and they like this, and okay, what can we do to help that along?
So the following year was your final one with WWF. What led to your decision to leave? And it seemed like right when the promotion was starting to pick up steam and turn around, you headed back down to Atlanta for WCW. What was the reason behind you leaving? And also, this longstanding story out there, is there any truth to the rumor that when you left, they switched plans and took the title shot and possibly the title off of Vader and went to Sid? Was there anything behind that that you're aware of?
Don't know, and I'm not divulging anything that isn't already in my autobiography as to the time that I was there and the circumstances under which I left. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to the meeting that Vince had with all the office personnel about having to tighten belts, and everybody tightened a belt, and that there was a $5 million write-off for legal expense, that the coffee service in the reg rooms was gone. They used to have a security staff. You had a swipe card to get in and park, but they also had uniform security staff. They were gone. It was a lot of little things that, I mean, they looked everywhere to cut expenses. Vince always had instilled in me from day one, you're here as a corporate person, and you have to stop thinking of yourself mentally as a wrestler and separate the two. And he had a lot of former wrestling people that were in the company. I mean, Fred Blassie worked in the mailroom. Jerry Briscoe was involved and had been involved going back to, when he sold his stock in Georgia, which Jerry was a partial owner, and Jerry would come up. Pat was a wrestling person. Lord Alfred Hayes was a wrestling person. Really, Howard Finkel was. Anyway, when that statement was made about cutting expenses, prior to that, when I first moved up there, I rented a house. And I'd been in the house, maybe 4 years. I don't remember the exact time frame, but I'd been in the house for a while. And it was okay. It was in a nice section where there was a good school system. And that's, where I chose to live, a little town called Wilton. Mm-hmm. And the owner of the property we were renting decided that they wanted to sell it. Well, it was okay for a house to rent, but it wasn't something that I wanted to own. And just happened to mention with Vince, when we were doing a creative thing on the weekend, I got to go out and we're looking around, got to move. The owner wants to sell the house and not interested in buying it. And so Vince said, well, you need to look for something to buy. You need to put your roots down here. This is it. This is your last stop. You're staying here, yada, yada, yada. So it ended up, looked around, found a house that I liked, and then Vince said, you need to buy the house, you need to stay here. And I'd had some financial problems prior to that. As I said, married three times. Anyway, long story short, Vince called the CFO of the company and said he wanted me to have this house and to go through our bank and do whatever needs to be done to make it happen. So, I mean, that sounds very reassuring that here's the president of the company, the head of the company, saying, you know, this is your home. And by that point, in other words, I had proved myself and he wanted me just to be there. To get it done, it involved me having to take some money out of my retirement fund, and also Vince advanced me some money, which I had signed a note to repay. It was an unsecured note, but I was paying so much a week out of my paycheck till that money was repaid. When he had that meeting about the $5 million deficit, letters went out, and shortly after that, I got a letter on Friday, and now I understand now that I have small children. I have gotten married, have small children. I moved into this house based on the conversation with Vince, and I think like anyone, you take on financial obligations based on, you know, the money that you're making. Between Friday and Monday, my salary was reduced by 40%.
Wow.
And I couldn't continue to pay on the note. And they said, oh, well, that's okay. We'll just kind of freeze that for a while. I mean, it had an unbelievable impact. And to be honest with you, that day I decided that I was not going to stay there. Mostly everybody else stayed. Lord Alfred Hayes walked out the door and quit. Never came back. Everybody else were cut. Mine was a little bit more severe. Of course, I guess I was making more money than some of those, but everybody else stayed. Now, what bothered me most was if Vince had gone to all of the corporate structure, going back to this conversation about, well, you can't be always thinking like a wrestler. You have to think like a corporate person. You're not a wrestler anymore. If he had called in all executive-level people and said, look, this, you know, following this meeting, I need for everybody to take a temporary salary decrease of 5%, 8%, whatever the number was, across the board, and let me get this thing turned around, and then we'll make it up. But Vince handpicked the quote-unquote wrestling people, and that's who got these steep reductions in salary. And I just decided that day, and the house that I had bought at his urging, it took me a year and a half to sell it.
Wow.
And when the house finally sold, the week before, my wife, I didn't know where I was going. I was, of course, fearful that Vince would find out, fire me, and now I'm out. I've got nothing. I'm out, you know. So I didn't know where to go. Didn't have another job in spite of what rumors might have been out there. Had not talked to anybody at WCW. I had been friends with Jerry Jarrett. I knew he had a company in Nashville. WCW was in Atlanta. Logic said, well, I had been a key player with Vince. I would have thought that I would be marketable to WCW, but there was no guarantee that I would. And then I thought, you know, worst case scenario, I'm kind of in the middle. I could go down to Orlando, which is an entertainment center, and possibly find something down there based on my experience. So my wife flies to Atlanta a week before, rents a house, has an address. We come back, arrange to have all the belongings in the house packed up, because you got to send them somewhere, and send them to the house that we dressed in, that we rented in Atlanta. And I lived in a hotel for a week. And the closing was on Friday. And we closed on the house. I think when all was said and done, we took a loss of about $50,000 on the house and netted about I had $20,000 to my name. Small kids, no job. And on a Friday afternoon, I knew Vince was in the office because I heard his voice down the hall, and I waited till mid-afternoon and just went, I said, Vince, could I have a minute with your time? Yeah, come on in, Pally. Walked into the office, and I said, Vince, came to your home, met you face-to-face the day you hired me. And so the day that I made a decision that I can't work here anymore, I felt the right way to do it was eye to eye, face to face. And I was in his office, just him and I slid the letter across his desk, and I said, here's my letter of resignation, effective immediately. And I said, if you want to talk about it, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. I understand. Well, by all means. And so we had a very intense conversation for probably well over an hour. And I don't know if he thought that I was bluffing or that I wouldn't do it, but little by little, I'd cleaned everything out of my office. I had a few personal pictures on the wall, so it wasn't totally obvious. And I got up and walked out of his office, went down the hall, told my secretary, I said, I just resigned. And I was on the fourth floor. I had an office halfway between Vince and Linda. And went down to Human Resources on the second floor, walked in, and said, here's a copy of the letter I just gave Vince McMahon. I'm resigning. Here's my swipe card coming in. Here's the keys to my office. And goodbye. I went down and got my car. And when you left, you pulled up and an eye from the inside opened the gate. And I pulled out and left. And my wife and I, since all the furniture was en route, we were in a hotel, we ended up going to Boston for the weekend and went to a couple games. Mm. And went to Atlanta and ended up, called Tony Schiavone. He set up a meeting with Eric Bischoff, who I had never talked to, never met. And it was right when the merger with Time Warner taking place, and they had a freeze on all hires. So he ended up getting me hired as a consultant for a month until that passed, and then I was hired.
Now, did you have any backstage duties in WCW like you did in the WWF, or were you strictly an on-screen character? Like, what was the parameters in the beginning?
In the beginning, I was brought in to work in the office. I wasn't coming in to replace somebody. Like, this is their office with their title and the name on the door, and I was like just an in-house agent or whatever. And I'm sure I caused a lot of concern. Kevin Sullivan was booking at the time, and all of a sudden I show up. Traditional wrestling thinking is oh my God, you know, something's going on. And I'm sure there was some paranoia, but the first meeting with Eric, I kind of thought, here's someone who has just worked side by side in the closest circle to Vince McMahon, who and I'm not talking about sharing any proprietary information, anything like that. I'm just talking about just general knowledge of process. and he had no interest in anything other than talking about obsessed with putting Vince out of business and how much longer can he last. And it was no questions asked, just silly statements like that. And I'm sitting there thinking, this guy knows absolutely nothing about the business. And if he thinks that he's going to put Vince McMahon, a second generation, a third generation being groomed into the business, out of business, he's out of his mind. But he's offered me a job, and so let's just see where I'll take the job and see where it goes. And so it kind of put us, meaning Bischoff and I, kind of on a collision course almost from day one. And as I thought about it later, I realized that, again, the longer I was there and found out that he knew nothing, and the people who were what they called the suits in the North Tower, which were the upper executives with Turner, they knew nothing about the wrestling business. And he had sold them a bill of goods, meaning Bischoff, that they had bought into. And so he almost had to hire me because of I was high profile, where I'd come from, how could he have explained to these people that all of a sudden one of Vince's right-hand men was on the open market and we're not going to hire him? So I think I was off. I was hired for that reason. And then analyzing it further, Eric could have looked at me in two ways. He could have looked at me as someone who was possibly a tremendous resource that had all of this firsthand knowledge working next to the man. Or the other way of looking at it was, he knows so much that he's going to be the first one to know that I know nothing. And as it turned out, it was the latter. And so he then alienated me, and I was not one to play politics and try to work my way into his inner circle. I didn't need to travel within his entourage. I preferred to do my own thing. So it right from day one, just that was how the relationship started. And I went there with the idea in mind, okay, with all this experience that I have in the business and at my age, the company at that point, I had left a month after the company had been formed, and now almost 8 years later, here I am coming back. They're still in business, and there's nobody left in the game but him and Vince McMahon, and the circumstances under which I left with Vince McMahon, which are further complicated by the fact that the weekend that I walked in with a letter of resignation was the day before Shane McMahon got married. And all of Vince's close friends, relatives were in town, and the fear was that I was going to pull some kind of grandstand play. Mutchnick in New York wrote all these negative things, and I don't know if Vince thought that I was going to go in, and it was crazy.
So, JJ, just looking at your on-screen run with WCW, did you enjoy that aspect of being in the company? Did you like being the foil for the NWO and the guy kind of, working with Sting and going against Hogan and Bischoff? Did you enjoy that part of it?
Well, they needed somebody to be like a commissioner spokesperson to initially make some announcements of, kind of like a Jack Tunney used to do with the original WWF. And so everybody kind of looked at me and said, he's a logical person. So they wanted to record something, and we went into one of the main offices and tight there in the CNN tower, put me behind a desk, and in one take got everything that they were hoping to get and more, and they thought, oh wow. So that's how I became their commissioner figure, and it was one of those things that no matter where I've ever been, or and you have to adapt to every place that you go to, depending on what that style is, whether it's the Eddie Graham style in Florida, you know, based around credibility of a Jack Briscoe, or whether it's crazy like Tennessee. You, as a talent, you have to go in and adapt to do well in that environment. So I've always been a team player, and that's what happened in this case. I mean, I was asked to do some things, and I was being paid, and I thought, well, my opinion was never asked. It's just, this is what you want me to do. And so I did some things that just I did because I was there being paid, and I'm a team player. Just leave it at that.
All right, thoughts before we wrap up on just three men, a couple that you worked with on screen closely. You can just give quick thoughts on these three guys. One is Chris Jericho, who you had a pretty good run with character-wise. Goldberg, his rise, and then Kevin Nash taking over as Booker and beating Goldberg. Just quick thoughts on those three things.
Chris Jericho is a great talent. And again, because Eric Bischoff knew absolutely nothing about the business. He did not see the talent that Jericho possessed, the raw talent, and didn't know what to do with him. The same as before that, he didn't know what to do with Steve Austin, didn't know what to do with Mark Calloway, who became The Undertaker. I mean, you go right down the list. And he basically made life intolerable for Chris Jericho, where Chris had no option but to let his contract expire and leave. And there was a woman who was the legal attorney who knew nothing about the wrestling business, but she was an entertainment lawyer, but almost exclusively the music business. And I remember the day that, well, Eric's letting Jericho go. We don't need him. In fact, we've already replaced him, and we've replaced him with somebody far better than him. Now, I'm sitting there knowing who all the players are in the business and who's available, and just thinking through my mind, who could she possibly be talking about? And as it ended up, and of course, she's wrapped up in, you know, the Eric magic, and whatever he says, she's accepting his gospel. And this is not a knock on the guy, but the guy who they were hiring that they thought was far superior and would replace Chris Jericho was Shane Douglas. And I was in the office with her, and I said, I've known Shane Douglas. Shane Douglas worked in the WWF when I was there, and left and went back to school teaching. And I said, I'm going to look you right in the eye and tell you that this is a huge mistake to have put Jericho into a position where he had no choice but to leave. And if you've been led to believe that with Shane Douglas, you've taken a step upward, boy, you're in for a rude awakening. And it was only in the confines of that office, now whether it was repeated or not or what. But I was a big fan of Chris. I called Chris, and I said, I know that you're letting your contract expire and have no interest to stay here with whatever offer, if any offer might have been made. And I said, where you're going with the talent that you have, you will become a huge star because they will know what to do with you. And I wished him well. Goldberg, they had the power plant, and Bill had blown his knee out, and basically his football career was over. And so he was working under contract developmentally and not making a fortune, but making decent money. I don't remember what the exact number was. But anyway, they were desperate for talent. It was at a time when Stone Cold was just screaming hot. And if you put a picture of Stone Cold and Goldberg side by side, physically, characteristic-wise, it's almost a mirror image, very close to it.
Yep.
So the thought was, oh, here he is. He's our Stone Cold. The problem is he's been working out in the power plant for 8 months or whatever the period of time was and has no experience. And again, this is where Eric didn't understand the business that, I mean, you could, it's like baseball. You put somebody in the batting cage and you know, have him take pitching forever, but to get into a game in live pitching and somebody's trying to get you out, it's a different ballgame. So anyway, they decided they had to go with Goldberg. And it was Kevin Sullivan's idea that, and it started the first week, like, well, we can't have him out there very long because he'll immediately be exposed to someone who is basically totally inexperienced. Certainly a great athlete, great physical look. I can't say he had an attitude problem. It's just that he totally lacked experience. So it started out with, well, we'll just give him this flashy entrance. He's got, you know, we'll give him one or two things that he does and can do those impressively, and we'll make this very short. And so that's how it started. Well, now what do we do next week? Well, we'll do what we did last week. And then before you know it, it was the streak. And it was extremely short matches, all of which were designed to camouflage the fact that he had no experience. And the problem was, the bigger problem was, that there was nowhere for him to get the experience. And even if we tried to book him in some of the small, tiny shows somewhere where he could go in front of no audience and learn and make, you know, learn by mistake, by errors and that kind of thing. I mean, it just was no place for him to go and get that experience at the major league level. And so the streak, as popular as it was and as much of a star as it made out of Goldberg initially, where was it eventually going to go? Because at some point he was going to have to be put into a position where he was going to produce, and he just didn't have the background and experience. And I think Kevin Nash, I consider Kevin a friend. He's had 15 surgeries or whatever the number is on his knee.
Wow.
He's a big guy. He played basketball in Europe. He's a big guy physically. Carries himself well. Knows how to market himself well. And he and Scott Hall, along with everybody else, were able to manipulate Eric Bischoff because Eric Bischoff knew nothing, and they knew that he knew nothing. And what would happen is we would go to TV. When the matches were over, Eric would go to the bar, start throwing them down, and then the guys would wait till he get hammered, and then would pull him off. And with Hall and Nash, they were accustomed to getting these huge royalty checks and merchandising checks because Vince pioneered that and had a system in place where, like, every quarter they would get a computer printout that would be thick like a phone book that had a line item of everything and a check at the end. And, of course, Eric was going to try and start that up from scratch. But their logic was, well, in the meantime, you know, you're going to have to make that money up to us somewhere else. And so that's how they systematically squeezed him. And it wasn't only them. The guys would wait till he would get hammered, and then they would corner him, and he would make promises. And then the next day, the guys would call me And they say, well, last night Eric said that from here on out, office is paying for my rental cars, or I'm flying first class, or, you know, whatever the thing might be. And I go down to see Eric. I said, Eric, you know, conversation last night with so-and-so. I don't exactly remember. Call him and find out specifically what, you know, and then I would come back to him and say, well, if I told him that's what I'm doing, then I guess I have to do it. And it just, I mean, you couldn't, if you were writing a novel, you, it's something like, you've heard that statement, the truth is stranger than fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what it was. And so, you know, I went there initially with the idea in mind that after leaving, because they were the only two players in the game, and obviously there was no going back to Vince. And so now here I was, and I thought I would go there and, you know, be able to stay and eventually retire and had benefits again as an employee and what have you. And the big difference was that, especially with Time Warner coming in and merging with AOL, now where Ted Turner had power at one point because he loved wrestling back to when the UHF station became the Superstation and the core programming was wrestling in the Atlanta Braves, and Ted had the power to say, nobody ever messes with my wrestling, and it stayed on the air and protected it, and even when times were lean, Ted would keep it afloat. And now he, through the series of mergers, you know, had a fancy title and what have you, but no longer had the stroke to kind of make major decisions as he had been able to do in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they caught up with Eric, and you know, the first month that they had a loss of $5 million, then all the suits that were in the North Tower that they were so impressed with how well he was doing, all of a sudden now started asking questions. And then it was the second month of $5 million losses, then the third, and then about the fourth or fifth month, and then they were, you know, they relieved him, but he's still under contract and being paid. And Brad Siegel, who was the president of TBS and of TNN and the guy that was making all the made-for-TV movies for TNN, he was the fair-haired guy that was close to Ted Turner. And as I look back, I'm not sure the problem could have been fixed at that point. It was so bad. But you think, okay, you know, it's just going to take some time. You can't turn around immediately. Well, Brad Siegel didn't understand the business and wasn't going to. I mean, he didn't have the patience for the time. And now I'm paying Eric Bischoff anyway. And of course, I'm sure Eric Bischoff was back in his ear at the same time. I know that he was. And it ended up that's how Bischoff got back into power, because they were paying him anyway. And the two people that were ostracized were myself and Kevin Sullivan. But we were under contract, and there was nothing he could do about it. So the last year I was there, basically I was in an office drawing a paycheck every week and doing absolutely nothing. Until one day, then it got to the $5 million losses after he had been put back in power. And AOL Time Warner said, this is just another division. And they had projected losses of, after they cut everywhere that they could cut in the way of guaranteed contracts, mm-hmm. they got it down to a loss for the year of like $160 million.
Wow.
With a projected loss of the following year for an equal amount. And they said, guess what? We're taking wrestling off the air because the new guy didn't like it anyway, and we're going to cut our losses. And it's just a division that we're going to pull the plug on. That's what they did.
Wow, $320 million in the last 2 years. That's crazy. Not surprising, but indeed crazy. One more question, JJ. And again, we thank you so much, both for part one and coming on again tonight. After what happened in WCW and your relationship with Eric Bischoff there, Do you regret leaving the WWF in 1996?
No. I had no... It's hard to explain. Mm-hmm. And the way I rationalized it myself was I'm a survivor. That if what Vince had done had impacted me alone, and I used the statement that I could survive if I had to, living in a phone booth, if it was just me. But because I had a wife and very small children, one of whom had special needs, and Vince did that to me, I then, how do you then work for him going forward on a long-term basis? I mean, the decision was made that day. The reason I was there another year and a half, because that's how long it took me to sell the house and get out from under it. And I'd already made up my mind. It just was wearing my game face every day. And the minute that house was sold, there was nothing there to hold me. And even though Shane was getting married the next day, I couldn't work for him one more day. I couldn't even wait till Monday and was gone. And with no job.
Well, JJ, we
some people call me crazy. Mm-hmm. Some people say, we admire you. You're a person of principle. And can't believe that you did what you did because you thought it was the right thing to do and you had no choice.
Well, JJ, we want to thank you for both parts of this interview and for being so open and honest with your answers. I know everyone that heard part one enjoyed it, and I know they'll love part two. And if you can't get enough of JJ Dillon like we can't, you can visit his website, jjdillon.com, order the book, the great book, well-reviewed book, Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls.
It's all in there. And, you know, it's like time has a way of healing all wounds. And in my book, I feel it was written at a time I was out of the business. I wasn't looking to sugarcoat anything with the hopes that the phone would ring and somebody would offer me a job. Also had no axe to grind with anybody. And I was very open and honest about the people that I'd worked with throughout my career. And I tried to be very honest about looking in the mirror at myself as to what I thought were my assets, where my shortcomings were, and be able to take a hard look at myself as well. And I feel when I look back, I probably was more complimentary to Vince than I was in any way critical to him, because he did give me an opportunity, and I it was an incredible education to see what he has accomplished there. Again, I said you can't argue with success. And do I agree with a lot of the things that he's done, a lot of the direction that he's taken? No. And I've said this before too, and we'll never have the answer to this question, that if it hadn't been Vince, if it had been as cable television then was changing the landscape of the industry and the territories were all gone, if it had been Eddie Graham, if it had been Jim Crockett, if it had been Bill Watts, if it had been Fritz Von Erich, if it had been Vern Gagne, where would the business be today? Would there even be a business? And we'll never have that answer. We don't know. And they all met and tried to put together a united front to see if they could stop him, and then they couldn't even come to an agreement on how they were going to do that, because they were all so accustomed to have their own individual territories and final say on everything. Mm-hmm. So we'll never know. But that's why maybe when I was chosen to be inducted with the Horsemen into the WWE of Hall of Fame, it probably was the most surprising phone call that I can remember receiving in a long, long time. And even up to the point thinking that, is it possible this is a cruel joke, until I saw it announced on the air, live raw, that it was going to happen. And even then, because you have to sign a contract because they sell the DVDs and it's a pay-per-view, and so that you have to grant those rights. So I had that in hand, and even when I got the plane tickets, I didn't know what the feeling would be like, whether it would be an icy reception or what it was when I got there. And it was a group setting when I saw Vince the first time, and it was all business. And then at the Hall of Fame, a half hour before the thing started, we were told that Vince was going to personally present each of us with our ring. And they brought the rings to us to sit here, try it on, want to make sure it fits. If it doesn't, we'll get it fixed. But, you know, Vince is going to give it to you and expect you to try it on. And I had no idea what to expect. And there were a line of chairs outside of a room. And I'm trying to think. I think Arn went first, then Tully, then Rick, and then me, and then Barry Windham was last. And in this room, they had a backdrop, and they had a shooting video, and they had a bunch of cameramen shooting pictures. And as the other guys got their ring, it was a private moment with Vince and took pictures. And then they stepped off, so they're still in the room. So by the time I got in, Flair's over there, Tully's over there, Arn's over there. And it's a private moment, but there's a room not full of people, but a lot of people in that room. And I went up to Vince, and I think it was John Laurinaitis that gave him the ring box, and he turned. And he said, here. And I said, Vince, I can't tell you how much this means to me personally and to my family. And he looked me straight in the face, put his hand on my shoulder. He said, we had some good times together, didn't we? I said, yeah, Vince, we did. Turned, snap pictures, walk off. And Barry came in last. And it was like, as has so often been the case, Vince had the perfect answer for the situation, that it was just the perfect answer to the situation. I didn't know what he was going to say. And when we each had our rings and we were all done, then they brought us all together, and we all had our Hall of Fame rings on, holding up the symbol of excellence, the four fingers. And right as we were about finished, Vince comes over, steps in the middle of us, and holds up the four fingers. And, gentlemen, I'm looking at that picture on the wall.
That's awesome.
They sent us some memorabilia, and that's a picture that is a very personal thing. I wouldn't copy it to send to somebody. And what's, as I the day that it came and I opened the package, as I look at the picture, Arn's on the left, then Tully, then me, then Vince, then Barry, then Flair. Unbelievable picture.
It's awesome.
Yep.
And another great emotional story that we'll thank you for, JJ. Once again, just really, this two-part interview has been unbelievable. The stories you've shared with us and just the career you've had is amazing. And we just want to thank you for giving us this time. And speaking of Hall of Fames, of course, on May 18th, you're going to be inducted to another one, the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Want to talk about that for a quick minute? That's the one that I actually, you know, as a kid, there was no Hall of Fame when it all started. And when the Hall of Fame started, and I, again, you know, I thought, boy, wouldn't it be great when you look at the names of someday, if my peers thought that I was worthy to be listed among them. Maybe that day would come. And then to get the call last year from the WWE just blew me away. The first class treatment, they flew all four of my children down there. I mean, I can't say enough about how I was treated. It was, and it's all captured on the WrestleMania video, and on the second disc is the whole ceremony, which was actually about 2 hours and 50 minutes, with all that we said, including me introducing my family, Tully introduced his family. And on top of that, when they edited it down to about 40 minutes to put on the air Monday of that week on Raw as a prelude, they chose, of course, Edge, and they chose Mike Tyson, and they chose us. And you can imagine the exposure from that. I mean, if I had a magic wand and could have willed anything, there was nothing that I mean, it was like a dream. And then this year to get the call that I was on the ballot, and when the votes came in and were tabulated, that I'm now being inducted into the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame on their 12th year. And if you look at my website, I posted a statement, and I mean that with all sincerity, that of all the awards that I've ever received, and this is not to be hypocritical or to in any way diminish what happened last year, but to be chosen by vote of a group of respected wrestling historians and by my peers, the people in the business that I spent my whole life with, including some inductees from prior years that are in the Hall of Fame, there can be no more prestigious honor. And there won't be 16,000 people there. It'll be sold out. There may be 400 or 500 people. I don't know. And there's no mega arena event the following day. But I can't describe to you how much this means to me. Again, I talk about having a storybook career and living my dream. And last year, then this. I mean, what else? There is nothing else for me. This is everything.
And both accolades and honors, very well deserved, of course.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So please check out jjdillon.com for more information on the induction to the Hall of Fame up in Amsterdam, New York, as well as the book Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls. And that, Place to Be Nation, wraps up our two-part interview with the one, the only, the legendary, James J. Dillon.
All right, Scott and Justin, I've enjoyed it the first time. It was great. You wore me out. But this time you had some great questions, and I think we got into some detail of that aspect of my career that probably most fans would have the greatest interest in. And again, as in my book, I was very honest with sharing my thoughts with you. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world. That's really all I can tell you. And I appreciate this opportunity to be able to share all this with you.
Well, Scott, that was opportunity of a lifetime. I can't imagine. You know, we're talking about our anniversary and our 200th episode. Would you have thought 200 episodes ago we'd be talking to J.J. Dillon for 3 hours on his career? I mean, what an honor, what a great opportunity that was. And we got more time than we expected, so that was great. We hooked him in again.
Yep, he finds a way. He always finds a way. The guy, what a storyteller. I mean, and I don't think we've ever had a guest be able to break down on us twice. I mean, that's pretty impressive. I mean, that story is just amazing. I got to say, JR, we've done 194 episodes, and we're going to have hopefully another 194 in our lives, our careers, and we got 200, number 200 coming up. But the two with him might right now be my two favorites. He was awesome. He was amazing. We've had some awesome guests, Capetta. And
I'm gonna tell Kevin that you said this. That his are not
he's
the not best.
He's not a guest. He's like extended correspondent. He's not a guest anymore. There. So, but yeah, I mean, that
I'll tell
was
John. Just, he'll come fuck you up. I think you're right. I mean, this was really a guy that I never would have thought we'd get to just sit and bullshit with, and the depth that he puts to his stories and the emotion and. you know, we ask him a question and you expect maybe just an answer, and the way he goes back weeks and months and sets the stage, you almost forget what the question was, and then he gets there and gets to the answer to the question, but he's already gave you all his backstory that makes you really get involved in what he's talking about. So it was really cool. He's a great storyteller. I mean, not a surprise. One of the best promo men in history.
Exactly.
And just a true legend. So we'll wrap there. It's been a hectic week. A good week, though. We got a lot of interesting shows. We got through SummerSlam 98. We had a great preview of the Royal Rumble yesterday. And now today we wrap with JJ. So we're going to take a week off, as we talked about. A little vacation week here as we ramp up for 200. We'll be back on the 4th with Breakdown, 1998. And then on the 5th with another interview, Scott. They just keep pouring in.
Oh, they're loving us. They're loving us. Former announcer for WCW, Scott Hudson, will be joining us. That'll be exciting.
And Graham will join us as well to do that interview like he did with Mr. Capetta. So that should be a lot of fun, Scott. Enjoy your week break. I know I'll enjoy mine. I'm going to talk to you. That's it. No radio communication at all. I'm going off the grid from you until February 4th. I don't want to look at you. I don't want to hear from you. I don't want anything to do with you.
All right. I'll talk to D'Amato then.
Good luck.
Yeah.
All right, Nation. Have a great week. We will talk to you on February 4th with Breakdown from Canada, I guess, right?
Yes.
Freaking Canadians.
Enjoy the Rumble.
Yes. Viva la Rumble.
Except you.
Yeah, I won't.
No blast areas.
Blast area. Fucking Hooters. Where are they? Why are they in Naples? The old people.
Yeah.